Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves, and today we are talking the shared island, and it's really something that we've been covering in some detail for a number of weeks now, a number of months as it is, but it's something that actually we're going to get into in a lot more depth, hopefully, on this conversation. As always, I'm joined by my co-host, Martin McMahon, who I had to get out of bed before Joe Duffy started. Martin, how are you?
It's early, Tony. It's I'm surprised that the light is out at this hour of the day. Do real people get up at this time?
It's what Leo Varadkar referred to as the people who get up early in the morning.
Yeah, the people who get up early so that they can pay exorbitant mortgages and rents. Yes,
I do want to touch on that actually. Again, Rory Hearn's latest podcast with Lorcan Sir and Killian Woods. Thousands of people listening to that as well. Do check it out because it puts an end to that myth that if we don't invite these, or if we don't give them the tax breaks and we don't give them the low rates of stamp duty and all the rest of it, that they just won't invest. Simple fact is, the facts don't add up on that. Go check it out. It's on the Reboot feed. Everything's up on Tortoiseshack. Anyway, enough of that. We are delighted to be joined by Professor Colin Harvey. He's Professor of Human Rights and Law in the School of Queen's University in Belfast, who's also one of the brains behind the Shared Island Project that I referred at the outset. Colin, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Well, thank you very much, Tony and Martin. Delighted to be here. Look forward to the conversation.
Yeah, Colin, I am going to start on a downer. You have been writing some really thought-provoking pieces for quite a while about what, you know, moves towards a united Ireland or a shared island and what that vision might mean. But yesterday we saw a young man, a 19-year-old man, speak of we can't rule out violence. And Colin, you've received, let's put it this way, vitriol and threats for opening some of these conversations. How have you found that aspect of it?
Well, Tony, first of all, it's important just to contextualize the discussion. It seems to me that in a post-Brexit context, it would be bizarre to not be talking about this, first of all, you know, so much of what I've been talking about out loud shouldn't be controversial, shouldn't be problematic, and really flows out of research. I've been doing it for many years, but particularly recently around the implications of Brexit. In terms of the discussion at the moment, you know, that'll be framed as clear by the Good Friday Agreement, peaceful and democratic means. It was slightly unnerving to hear the references the other day, you know, to the possible use of force, but that has no place in the discussion. You know, my sense is there's a real appetite across the island to talk about the details of all this. So I think we just get on with the work of doing sensible planning and preparing for where we might all be going next.
I think that's really, I'm so glad that you're able to contextualize it like that and see that. But again, the echoes of a small minority, and then you see the recent upsurges in violence, you can't help but hear, you know, the echoes of the troubles. We know these aren't the same. We spoke to Gareth Mulvenna, you know, the historian. He's telling us no, there's a huge difference between the tartan gangs and what's going on in some of these communities, and a lot of it is, you know, actually comes back to some of the stuff that you're talking about: socioeconomic problems, social mobility, lack of education attainment, and we'll get into that now. But just, sorry, you wanted to come in.
Well, no, I think first of all, it was important for people like me and have a responsibility to be very, very clear about where we're currently at. I don't think it's any secret that, you know, in relation to the work I've been doing, the unionist political parties here have taken a considerable interest, and social media, I've been called a variety of words that I don't think I actually am aware of myself. So, and I've come under a lot of, for a lot of attention, let's say, in relation to some of that. But I don't think it's useful for people like myself, academics, people who are engaged in this discussion, to be silent or back away from the hard questions. You know, I think that's one of the problems this society has faced. And also, when we think about the Good Friday Agreement, people are perfectly entitled to have a view about the constitutional future. They shouldn't be afraid of expressing that out loud. So, you know, my hope is by taking a position on this, articulating that out loud, that others will feel confident about also following that as well. Because, you know, I would be worried, you know, if you're living in the North and you feel afraid really to share your views on what is an absolutely, you know, mainstream aspect of the Good Friday Agreement, then something is profoundly wrong. I think in terms of unionism and loyalism, absolutely right that unionism sets out in a coherent way the case for maintaining the union. But really, you know, where I started was, it would be, Tony, it would be bizarre if in the light of Brexit, where the North has been essentially forcibly removed from the European Union against its will, without its consent, if we weren't having this conversation. European Union made clear in April 2017, we have an automatic way back to the EU. It would be, you know, I'm surprised there's not more public conversation about that.
Going to stop the pod here. Just want to ask again, I'm going to be straightforward about this. We need money to keep this podcast going. And that means patrons. That means you, your friends, people who listen to this. We do this for free. I mean, it goes out for free, but it has a value. So please stick your hand in your pocket. Tony, you've thoughts on this too.
Oh, well, it's just actually, I was looking at it today, Martin. We submitted the new RSS feed for Built Different, so that's on its way. If you're a Patreon subscriber, you've already heard the first episode. The second episode is in the can, and we're working on it. And I'm thinking how important the Tortoise Shack has been as a little platform that could, Martin. That's what I think about, the difference that it's made. You know, you and the PAC, Rory on TV fighting for housing, Vicky doing incredible work, Caroline actually becoming the de facto sexpert of Ireland, you know, all of these things. And then you add in Conversatrans, which is just unique. It's absolutely unique. An audio history of the story of trans people of Ireland. And now we've Built Different coming. And all of it was just because we decided we'd have a crack at this. We knew it wasn't viable. Unfortunately, it's still not viable. But when I look at the numbers, I just understand that there's thousands of you listening. So if a couple of you, if a fraction of you decide that, you know what, you thought you want to see it keep going and you want to see where this goes, it's patreon.com/tortoiseshack. It's really that simple, Martin. It's just a couple of quid.
Let me just give that again, Tony. patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Going to let you go back to your podcast now. Thank you.
European Union made clear in April 2017, we have an automatic way back to the EU. It would be, you know, I'm surprised there's not more public conversation about that, you know, because Scotland would give whatever for that position, you know. So I think that's what we need to focus on. As relating to the other theme there, the recent people like me are engaged in the discussion. I've worked all my life in the areas of equality, human rights, social justice, because, you know, my view is we can do a lot better for everyone. So, you know, when I talk about human rights, you know, I'm concerned about the human rights of everyone in this society, whatever background they're from, whatever community they're in.
And as an academic, do you find that there is a move across academia to discuss this seriously and get into the granular detail of what a united Ireland would look like?
Absolutely, Martin. What's been clear in the last number of years, really remarkable, is every other week, there's a new project or initiative that's announced. You know, there are a range of academic initiatives that are ongoing that are looking at the technical, tedious, and excruciatingly boring detail of a referendum process and what a new Ireland, what a united Ireland would look like. One of the problems in this debate for far too long has been that it's been rather theoretical, abstract, aspirational. So, you know, one thing that universities can do and can do well is to begin to tease out the options, what they mean, what are some of those hard questions, to do the homework well in advance. And what's been commendable about the whole discussion and isn't given the credit it deserves is that the focus has been entirely on planning and preparation and getting it right. The sense that we're heading towards these referendums, we've seen the absolute Horlicks in around Brexit. I don't know why Horlicks keeps getting referred to in that context, but there you go. Don't really want to do the same thing on this island. So I really just want to commend everybody, including universities, You're just doing the hard work, when moving beyond the rhetoric, you know?
Colin, when you say doing the hard work, there's a lot of, like, one of the hard questions is, and it goes to predominantly our audience, is steps that people in the South have to take to show the unionist community that they will be welcome in a shared island. You know, are there things that spring to mind that we should be taking, particularly to persuade unionists that there's a place at the table and they won't be, they will, you know, as you said, human rights for all doesn't mean, you know, it doesn't mean that they have less. It means that we all can share in it.
Yeah, and so it's a great question. Read two responses to that. First would be essentially that, you know, mutual respect requires, you know, an acknowledgement that, particularly for political unionism, may not want to get involved in a question about designing a united Ireland. That's perfectly fine. You know, political unionism will primarily want to be thinking about building the case for maintaining the union. And I think we have to respect that, you know. But I think those who are advocating change need to get on with the work of making the case. So if you're going to turn up on a doorstep in the north or the south and you're going to be arguing for constitutional change, what are you going to say? You know, what's the detail contained? What's the manifesto? What's the prospectus? And I think change advocates just need to get on with doing that. But one thing would be very, very useful at the moment. You know, there's a tendency in the south to tiptoe around this discussion, to shy away from it, to use euphemisms for what we're actually talking about. I think the better approach is for those in the South who would like to see this conversation progress, make clear to all communities in the North, including unionist and loyalist communities, and the, you know, diversity of communities emerging here, that they would be warmly and openly welcomed in any new constitutional arrangements, and people will be delighted to see it. So, you know, in a spirit of invitation, I think the Irish government, for example, shouldn't shy away from making absolutely clear that they would warmly welcome new constitutional arrangements in which unionism, loyalism would play an absolutely central part. I think there's just been too much sort of tiptoeing around that and shying away from it in the language, you know, of inclusion and the language of a warmth of a welcome. But also, I suppose, Tony, finally, just, you know, you don't have to wait for United Ireland to take steps now to show that. So, you know, rather than the rhetoric, maybe some steps could be taken now to show people that, you know, unionism will be warmly welcomed in the new arrangements. Why wait for United Ireland to do that?
And politically, that takes some moving politically. I mean, it is better to be a big fish in a small pond than a small fish in a big pond. But are there real genuine fears about loss of rights from the unionist side? Are there genuine fears that they would not be accommodated in an all-Ireland?
Absolutely, yeah. In a sense, if unionism, the clue is in the title. You know, unionism is primarily concerned with maintaining the union with Britain. Political unionism does not want, by definition, a united Ireland. So you're talking about a community and a political community that, by definition, is questioning of constitutional change. So I think that's a real live issue. The way that you deal with that is you don't tinker with the voting arrangements, for example, in terms of the Good Friday Agreement. You make absolutely clear that the values and principles of the Good Friday Agreement will be respected in new constitutional arrangements. And you also take that further. You make sure that there are clear guarantees around equality, human rights, social justice, and the sort of parity of esteem, mutual respect commitments that are in the agreement. So, you know, again, there's a tendency to focus, you'll know yourselves at the moment, on, you know, the voting issue in the 50+1. I think that's a distraction. I think that's resolved and clear. What people should be focusing on is what's the proposition and how will the assurances be given to everyone, you know, not just unionism and loyalism, but everyone here, that they will be respected and protected in new arrangements. And that's where the detailed work needs to be done now.
And I think the idea that two words there, new arrangements, very important. I mean, it could be anything from, you know, obviously we talk about constitutional change, a new constitution, there's talks of new flags, new anthems, all of this stuff that goes on around, but there's also possibilities of, say, maybe similarities to having autonomous rule in some aspects of how people, you know, politically are governed. And, you know, we have to have those conversations. Is it fair to say that those are the type of things that we need to be honest about and put some detail on?
Definitely need honesty and detail in relation to all of those. And that's why it's been very interesting to watch proposals around, for example, an all-island citizens' assembly and civic engagement. We've seen that, you know, citizens' assembly forums where people engage, constitutional conventions, can be very, very helpful in dealing with some of these hard questions, so as that they're not answered in a sort of top-down way by people like me or politicians, but they engage and they evolve from civic engagement and dialogue. So I think one of the things that's very useful at the moment, that before we have referendums on this island, I think it's absolutely essential that we have something like a citizens' assembly first to tease out some of these issues. What's really striking in the discussion, however, is that, you know, the stereotype and caricature is often that this is all going to be about symbols and flags and culture and identity. But what's really, really striking is it's the socioeconomic issues that are often front and center of people's minds. And the big one, for example, is the health service and health provision. You know, will people be better off or worse off? And
Aoife Grace Moore joined us. She joined us every few Sundays. We do a live show. And one of the things she was like, but don't touch my NHS kind of thing, you know. And that was the big concern coming out from a good Derry woman herself. And
absolutely.
And it was. But I think that is another, and I know, Martin, you want to come in, but I do think you're spot on pointing out socioeconomic, and again, it keeps coming up, whether we're speaking to Brian Smith from the Green Party, or we're speaking to Garrett Mulvenna, or we're speaking to Sean Murray. We spoke to Kula Yusuma, the Children's Commissioner. It is class. It is a lot of class issues. It's you know, social mobility and educational attainment, and the ability to be housed securely and have a reasonable standard of living is and can that be provided on an all-Ireland basis? Do you know, because we hear the things, the scaremongering that goes on here, and it goes on here in parts of our media, is that we can't afford this. We can't afford this. Have you seen, you know, the evidence of any of the conversations that you've had, any evidence that backs that up? Because some of the stuff I've seen shows the island itself would be more attractive to investments and capital. What's your feeling on that?
My feeling on that is it's entirely positive, that it's an opportunity to do something that we've been avoiding for 100 years, which is to engage with each other properly on the island. It's an opportunity for doing something better. You know, people use the word increasingly in New Ireland as a result of this discussion, and I think it's not about making people worse off. There's a sense in which the division on this island is limiting our potential. And so by removing that division, stopping and avoiding it, if you like, that we can do much better. You know, the evidence that I've seen emerge around the potential, you know, convinces me that we will be better off. Obviously, there's more work being done at the moment. It's been interesting to see, for example, the ESRI and the Shared Island Unit beginning to do more scoping projects around this. And a lot of the detailed, I'm not an economist, but a lot of that work is being done. But it's persuading me that this will be a conversation on which we'll be better off at the far end of it. We'll be a healthier society, North and South, for having had the discussion. But, you know, when people talk about a new Ireland, you know, I think they mean it. You know, they would really like to see us do better in terms of human rights, equality, and social justice, North and South. And the current arrangements, look, I'll be very clear in relation to the North, the current arrangements aren't working. Yeah. and there's an appetite for change.
And when you talk about a new Ireland, that's something that really hasn't sunk in down south, is that it's not just that we absorb Northern Ireland, it's that the whole island changes. Everything changes. Our political system changes.
Oh, Cork won't change. I wish it would, but they won't.
But it does, to a great degree, threaten the establishment status quo to have a united Ireland and a new united Ireland. It means, you know, you have to be politics north and south at the same time. Whereas at the moment, it's very easy for politicians to point and say, you know, up there, you're doing X, Y, and Z, or you're not doing X, Y, and Z, as the case may be. Do you think that Irish politicians have got their heads around that this is a complete game changer for everybody?
It's a great question. There's no doubt, you know, that this is going to be a challenging discussion for the Irish state, for many of the existing parties on the island, you know, who are defined in many ways by the division on the island now. And obviously, this is a challenging, difficult discussion. But I think I'm ultimately heartened to see, you know, you have a situation now where you have members of political parties, a range of political parties engaging very thoughtfully in the discussion. So it's just a matter of encouraging that along. I think rather than seeing it as a threat, again, you know, it's an opportunity to, you know, deal with what we've been avoiding for the last 100 years and to doing better. And I think everybody will be better off at the far end of that. But I understand, you know, it will shake things up on the island. But my view is it will shake things up on the island for the better of the people who live on the island. Mm. You know, one of the things about this right in the Good Friday Agreement, it belongs to the people of the island, north and south. It doesn't belong to politicians. And that's why civic engagement in shaping this is so vital and so important. But obviously, politicians and political parties have their role. And it's a good point. People often start first with saying, well, unionist parties, they'll be very anxious about this rightly. But you're right to point out Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, maybe parties who have held power for decades and decades might have to do a bit of sharing, you know.
I would have thought that there's as much intransigence in some parts of the Irish political system as there is in the unionist political system. I would have thought that there is just the same kind of intransigence.
I think that change can unsettle, you know, anyone, and small C conservatives everywhere get anxious about change. But I equally think there are a growing number of people in the system, if you like, north and south, who have a clear-sighted sense of where this is all going post-Brexit, and sensibly, I think, are beginning to sketch out and scope out how you manage that in a responsible way. I think the Irish state can do this. Yeah. It's showing its capacity to do remarkable things. This is about a management exercise, a managed transition over time. And just also bear in mind that there'll be people dancing in the streets all around the world when this happens. You know, the amount of goodwill there is for the reunification of this island is absolutely incredible. There will be European Union support. There will be international support, and it won't just be rhetorical support. It will be tangible, structured support as well. And it'll be a managed transition over time. And it'll be heartening to see when it does happen.
Colin, I was going to make a point there about the fact that we have politicians on this side saying, yes, I want to see it, but just not now. And they have this kind of at some vague time. But that's not how you plan for anything. You have to have a time frame. You have to have, you know, you know as well as I do, goals need to be specific, measurable, achievable, realistic, and timely. Yeah. You know, and in terms of the time frames that we see on these things, I'm gonna tell you, the morning that I woke up and the Brexit vote had happened, I text a very well known journalist and said, genuinely said, my first message was, I can't believe I'm going to be alive to see United Ireland. And he said, what do you mean? I said, that vote yesterday meant that we're already on the road to something that was going to happen, you know, inevitably. It just sped up the locomotive. What sort of time frame do you think we are realistically looking at? And I'm glad you've kind of put it that it's going to be a gradual process, but how gradual do you see it?
Well, again, it's important to talk about timing. I know people are very reluctant, understandably, to begin talking about dates, and there's been a bit of pushback around that. And I understand that, but my view on that is a bit more nuanced, in the sense that I think without some kind of time frame, very little homework would get done on the island of Ireland. You know, that very little project planning of any magnitude gets done if you have no time frame for doing it. Now, I know some people are resistant to that, but I think that if you don't have a time frame, the work won't get done. People will avoid doing hard homework. And so my sense is, and I'm personally convinced, that over the course of the next decade, these referendums will happen. Yeah. So for me, it's a rather boring exercise in getting ready for that, making sure that people know what they're voting for or against, know what will happen on the far end of it, and are prepared, well-informed for an evidence-based conversation. And I think ultimately we'll be better off North and South for having that and doing that. So I see over the course of the next 10 years, this decade, as a key moment, really accelerated, as many people recognize, by Brexit, its implications, and where Boris and the Brexiteers seem to want to go in the future. So,
I was going to say, do we have to reach a tipping point? But it sounds like you think we've already reached a tipping point.
I think we've reached the tipping point of preparation. I think when you begin to see the number of initiatives, when you begin to see university projects, even I know the Shared Island Unit is rather shy of referring to some of this, but I think in reality, there would be no Shared Island Unit if it wasn't for the sort of momentum that's building around this conversation. So I think there's a growing recognition among political parties, civic society across the island, that whatever you view on the constitutional future, we need to be ready. We can't just stumble into these things. Also, you know yourselves, the Secretary of State, Brandon Lewis, has a significant role in triggering this. You know, so you have a sort of a cabinet minister in the British government, could, you know, a fundamental role in what happens on this island. So it would be rather idiotic, in my view, not to be ready and anticipate that, given what we've seen.
Are there actually? That's it. Raises an interesting question around the British state's reaction, because you know there's suggestions that they may have an exit tax in effect, that you know, because they have, you know, they're paying British pensions to British citizens and British and Irish citizens and the likes of that, and this will then become the way that, you know, the Irish, you know, shared island, whatever the makeup of that is, then we then have to step up and cover these things, whether it's the NHS or it's pensions and these, you know, are there talks about those type of things? Because I know for all the talk, and we give Boris an awful time, and rightly so for the most part, they did at least go to a white paper to look what United Ireland would look like, you know, much to the chagrin of the DUP, but they did take that step.
Well, I think there's two things. One thing is that there's a lot of work ongoing at the moment, detailed research work around myth busting in terms of the debate around the subvention and, you know, to the north and the economics of all that. You know, work being done by people like Seamus McGuinness in the ESRA and recently John Doyle at DCU, who've been really essentially, I think, looking at the evidence and busting a few myths around some of that. Related to that, you're right. You know, one of the things that we need to clarify in advance of the referendums is what will happen afterwards. Yeah. And I think that what will be required, in my view, is that the British government will have to put its cards on the table in terms of the far end of that and the managed transition and its responsibilities. You know, it won't just be, you know, it won't be a day in which the sovereignty is transferred. There'll be a managed transition over time in which the British government will have, in a sense, I think, you know, ongoing financial and other responsibilities to the north, you know, tapering out over a period of time. But, you know, there's a view that, you know, that might all happen after the ref. My view on that is that needs to be ironed out in advance. Mm. You know, if the British government is going to respect its obligations under the Good Friday Agreement, it really needs to put its cards on the table first. And that needs to happen between both governments. So although the Secretary of State has an important role, I do think both governments now need to be talking to each other about sketching out the parameters in a way, you know, not dissimilar to the preparations that led to the Good Friday Agreement too. So, you know, I would call on both governments and the Irish government at the moment in particular to begin to sketch out, begin to engage with the British government on the parameters of the process.
We can't afford what happened with the Good Friday Agreement, though, that once the agreement was signed, that nothing else happened after that for 23 years. I mean, we must have some sort of progressive plan for afterwards. I mean, it's not just a matter of people will vote and the very next day you have a united Ireland. There are pros and there will be bugs and stuff to be worked through. How long do you see the post-transition? Maybe 5 years kind of thing?
Well, I think, first of all, it's a good point in terms of, you know, both governments having to sketch out and agree both before the process in terms of a referendum and the transition afterwards. And I think that will require a number of agreements. My view, that should all happen in advance and that we should know about that in advance. Also, in relation to that, bear in mind that international actors, there will need to be an international element to this. I think it would be very, very helpful, for example, in relation to the role of the European Union and the US, for there to be international oversight of the process, both before and after, because you've raised the vital point, Martin, in terms of what is agreed in terms of timescale and commitments afterwards. That's implementation. It's, you know, what we've seen here over the last 23 years is it's all well and good to have an agreement in writing. But if you haven't got effective mechanisms to implement that, right, if you haven't got effective mechanisms to hold the British government, for example, to account in the event of a united Ireland, they'll be meaningless. So, you know, I would urge all of those people thinking about this now to pay particular attention to issues of enforcement and implementation of any obligations that are undertaken around this. But I think, you know, without necessarily putting a time frame on it myself, there will be, you know, the British government will be engaged and have responsibilities in relation to the North for a significant period of time after reunification happens. But also keep in mind the Good Friday Agreement is relational. It involves relationships across these islands. And it'd be absolutely important, for example, that the British-Irish Intergovernmental Conference remains, continues to operate and functions well after Irish reunification. And the same with institutions like the British-Irish Council. So it's not a matter of British state, British government disengaging. I think all those relationships have to continue and flourish after reunification as well.
A lot of people will wake up and still identify as British.
Yeah, and will, that right is guaranteed in the agreement. You know, yeah. The agreement contains a commitment, a right, a birthright obligation around being British, Irish, or both. Both governments have agreed that that essentially is a right in perpetuity and that will continue into the future. Obviously, in relation to the implementation of that, the Irish government can't grant that British citizenship, right? So that would be for British government and British Parliament to Westminster Parliament to implement in the future. But that's a right. It's there in the agreement. And it relates to the earlier point too. You know, those agreement values about mutual respect, equal treatment and parity of esteem, although they're not very well respected here now in the North, you know, must be respected in the future in any new constitutional arrangement. So absolutely right.
Yeah, I think I want to go a couple of, you've hinted at a couple of things. Here's putting on my financial head. I would imagine we'd be looking at some sort of financial support from the EU as well to through the phase. And I'd actually think the EU would like, as you said, this would be a good news story for the EU. This would be something that they could help do and, you know, would be seen as something. Do you anticipate A, financial supports as well as you said, oversights? And then B, say a practical thing like maybe the PSNI, you know, how do we merge our two police forces and those things? Or do we just have an ongoing, are these things going to be gradual and residual?
Well, there's two elements to that. The first element is around the European Union. Let's be clear. This is constitutional change that will be happening in an EU member state. Yeah. So it's not just out of largesse that the EU will be involved. It'll be happening in an EU member state in the way that that's already been agreed. So the EU, both its member states and institutions, will have a significant interest in the success of that project, yeah, and in supporting a successful project within one of its member states, where it has already given a promise in terms of what will happen in the event of that vote. Tony, your question highlights, you know, a point that is neglected, that issue of international support, not just in the EU, but more broadly for what will happen here. But I'd also highlight another point, you know, the evidence that's available thus far, and there's been some research done on this, but there's work in progress as well, is that there will be significant economic benefits for the island in reunification. And this will, in some senses, unleash that economic potential of having a fully integrated island, if you like, within the European Union, finally at last realizing its potential with particular implications for the North, but also for everyone. You know, in your second question about the PSNI raises an intriguing dimension to the conversation. Which model of a United Ireland are we going to go for? So one of the areas where there is a need for more work and research, but some work is ongoing, you know, is it going to be a highly centralized unitary state, yeah, where the assembly and executive goes, and, you know, is it going to be a unitary state where there's significant devolution, where the assembly and executive and northern institutions largely stay? Or is it going to begin to look like something that's much more federalized, you know, where ultimately sovereignty switches, but much of what we see today continues as is? And I think that's a discussion that needs to be had here, but it needs to be had in the context of the civil society engagements we've talked about already. Because I suppose rather than what people like me can do is we can sketch out models, right? So if you choose model A, that's what it looks like. Choose model B, model C, model D. But what I'd like to do is hear from people. And what's emerging in some of the evidence I've seen so far is that we often go into these discussions with assumptions, right? And the assumption is that, well, you know, unionism and loyalism will want the assembly, they want the executive, you know, PSNI, all to. But when you get into more detailed conversations with people, those views can begin to shift. So I think we need to see more work around that. But your question raises a crunch issue, right? I think one of the issues particularly clear in unionism and loyalism is a profound sense of identification with Northern Ireland identity, with Northern Ireland as an entity. And that shines through in everything that unionism and loyalism has to say. So in terms of a United Ireland, you know, is one way to meet that expectation is to carry on with much of the symbolism, the language of Northern Ireland, including in the way that policing, for example, is structured on the island. So
you sound hopeful for the future, Colin, and you do sound hopeful. I suppose Ireland, if we do, and we do get this right, and we are an example to the rest of the world, even though it doesn't feel like it at the moment, we are an example of what can be done in other parts of the world. And maybe that view from the outside might help us to focus on what we need to do on the island to get it right. But you sound really hopeful. And it's a pleasure to talk to somebody who sounds hopeful about a united Ireland.
Maybe a just rather naive academic at this point, but I think like what an amazing thing to be involved in a discussion about the potential transformation of the island that you live in. You know, Martin, I know, like, I get up and say this first question I often get from journalists is, but what about loyalist violence? What about, and the conversation.
And I fell into that trap straight away. Yeah.
But, you know, so that then leads to, you know, I understand why that question is raised, and I'm very acutely conscious of that issue at the moment. But ultimately, not interested really in having a fear-filled discussion, an anxiety-ridden discussion about the future. I'm more interested in having a conversation about what we could do better. I think it's a remarkable opportunity. It's exciting. You know, think about, you know, being involved in the constitutional project, about the redesign of the place that you live. You know, in my mind, this situation at the moment isn't working. Brexit is a disaster. Boris and the Brexiteers, who knows where they're going? It's not a project that I have any interest in. And I think we've been avoiding this discussion on the island. So I think, right, and I may be wrong, and in 10 years' time, you can do a podcast and say, well, we, you know, look, it didn't turn out so well or not, but I think we'll be healthier and better off on the island for talking to each other we're too siloed. We don't engage with each other enough. And, you know, we need to get beyond the rhetoric, theories and abstract thinking and do the hard work and just prepare for these referendums and we'll see what the outcome is.
And Queen's University will still be Queen's University. We won't change it to Mrs. Windsor's University. We'll still call it Queen's University.
No. They call it Cove now, don't they?
Colin Harvey, thank you so much for coming on and having this conversation with us. We hope to have many of these over the next, we'll say 5 years. We'll just throw that out there. Thank you very much for coming on and having this conversation with us.
Fantastic. Thank you very much.
I got to let you, we will be back shortly, guys. We will be going back to Gaza this evening. Things continue to look absolutely awful, but there are talks of a ceasefire that's imminent. And Hannah was in touch with me this morning and said she's charging her devices now that she has a bit of electricity. And we hope to be able to bring you some coverage from on the ground in the next few hours. So keep an eye on your feeds and we'll be with you as soon as we can. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you all soon. Take care. Bye bye.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber podcast. Subscribe now on Patreon.